Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember how the Federal Reserve was going to get out of the economy? You know, once everything starts getting better? Yeah, never mind. The Fed met today and didn't really like what it saw. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, today the 10th of August. Glad you could be with us. The Fed, as widely predicted here and elsewhere, didn't do a thing on short-term interest rates at its meeting today. The federal funds rate is going to stay at a record low 0.25%. But as so often happens when Mr. Bernanke and the gang get together to chat, it's not about what they did, it's about what they said. In its statement accompanying the rate announcement, the Federal Open Market Committee said two things of note today. First, that it's going to keep on investing in government debt as a way to drive interest rates lower through the market. Two, that it's doing that because the pace of the recovery has slowed. As it happens, yesterday, the San Francisco Fed released a report of its own. It said the odds of an economic double dip are at about 50-50 over the next 2 years. Since we're all too familiar with what a recession feels like, we asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth what a second hit might feel like.
A lot like what we've got right now, only worse.
A recession would show us returning to a story of significant layoffs in many industries.
Lynn Reeser is chief economist of Point Loma Nazarene University and president of the National Association for Business Economics.
We also would see home prices and sales drop significantly. The commercial real estate market would deteriorate.
She says people would stop spending money. So would companies. State and local governments would be in even more trouble than they already are. If things got bad enough, the whole financial system could freeze up again. But like a lot of economists, Reeser thinks it's pretty unlikely. Paul Ashworth is senior U.S. economist at Capital Economics. He says it would take something really serious to push us into a double dip.
It's not uncommon to have lulls in recoveries. But it really does take a fairly big shock to drive an economy that's already been in recession recently back into recession.
And he says everyone's being much too cautious for that to happen. Policymakers are working on new strategies to keep money moving. Banks aren't lending much, and people aren't buying much either. The more likely scenario, a long, slow recovery. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
All right, here's another economic milepost. For the first time, student loans in this country have overtaken credit card debt. Americans owe more to private student lenders and the federal government than they owe credit card companies. Scary, but not necessarily a bad thing, as Amy Scott reports now from the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland.
As of June, Americans owed about $826 billion in revolving credit. Most of that is credit card debt. Our student loan bill totaled about $830 billion. That's according to Mark Kantrowitz. He publishes the financial aid website FinAid.org. For one thing, he says more people are going to college.
The number of financial aid applications has gone up by about 20% year over year. And more of those families have greater financial need due to unemployment and other impacts of the economy on their personal finances.
Families are also borrowing more because college is getting more expensive. And Kantrowitz says students are now more likely to get loans from the federal government instead of grants that don't have to be paid back. But there's another big reason for the debt shift. People are paying down their credit cards. Economist Julia Coronado with BNP Paribas says that's a mixed blessing.
In the short run, it means that we have a very slow and painful recovery because consumers are being more conservative. But in the long run, that means that their balance sheets will be stronger and their saving foundation won't rely just on rising stock prices or rising house prices.
So which kind of debt is better? Credit card debt tends to cost more in the form of higher interest rates. Student loans are much harder to get rid of in bankruptcy. but Coronado says the investment usually pays off. Studies show people who finish even some college earn a lot more than those who don't go at all. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Changing gears here now. We have known for decades that mercury is incredibly toxic. The government regulates factory emissions of the stuff, and the newest in that category as of this week is cement plants. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Cement is the glue that holds together concrete, which, as the industry puts it, is the foundation of the construction economy.
And in fact, it is the second most used material on Earth, second to water.
John O'Hare is with the Portland Cement Association. He says plants can't avoid spewing mercury. It's in the limestone that gets crushed and heated to make cement. The regulations will force plants to install expensive pollution filtering equipment or shut down.
We were looking at shuttering as many as 40 cement plants, which represents about 40% of our current U.S. cement manufacturing capacity.
On the other side, EPA says the rules will cut mercury emissions every year by 16 tons. And this is toxic stuff. Remember, even a broken old-school thermometer is cause for alarm. John Walk at the Natural Resources Defense Council is a fan of the new rules. He's an even bigger fan of the Obama administration's EPA.
The mindset at EPA under the current administration is vastly different from the deregulatory agenda of the Bush administration.
And the agency's just getting started. It's expected to put up mercury rules for coal-fired power plants, which may put the oldest plants out of business. And greenhouse gas rules are coming, too. Congress has enacted, but the EPA believes it can regulate carbon dioxide under the existing Clean Air Law. And the regulators have withstood a recent court challenge. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Traders were cranky waiting for the Fed's interest rate announcement today. They cheered up a bit once they read it. Still going to be the sad music, though, when we get there. We will have the details when? Yes, when we do the numbers. Google is having kind of a tough week PR-wise. Yesterday, the company that made the phrase, "don't be evil," popular said maybe it is okay after all to charge different prices for different kinds of content online. And then today, a story in the Wall Street Journal has some details about how Google is deciding to capitalize on the enormous pile of user data it has to turn a profit. Jessica Vassallaro wrote the piece on Google's data vision statement in the Journal this morning. Jessica, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Obviously, there's a bunch of stuff in this Google vision statement that they wrote without intending for anybody to see it. But what are they thinking about in terms of doing stuff with our data?
Well, back in 2008, when Google employee was working on this, they were specifically thinking about ways to show people ads targeted to their interests. And obviously, the more relevant the ad, the more the advertiser will pay for it. So what Google's looking to do is says, you know, we have a ton of data about users. What can we use to help deliver more relevant and therefore also more expensive ads to consumers?
Give me an example, would you, of how they know what they know about us? How do they know what to set in my Gmail advertising space, for instance?
The ads that you're seeing in your Gmails, they're related to what's written in your Gmail. So if you have emailed a friend about a vacation to Hawaii, you're most likely going to see a Hawaii text ad. Google employees do not sit there and read everyone's email. They have computers that do the matching.
It seems to me, and you point this out in your article, that the power structure on the web really has shifted from people who have the most eyeballs going to their sites to people who have the most data about the users who go to their sites, and then they can trade on that data and make more money.
All ad companies are looking for data. You know, they're looking for it to sell more advertising, but also just to make the actual internet service more customized and personal. A good example is search. Google can tailor what search results you see based on data about what you've searched for in the past. So there's a big land grab out there to get the most on lots of different interactions people are having online because there's a lot of money in it.
Google is obviously far and away the biggest moneymaker from ad search out there. But as you point out in your piece, their revenue growth is slowing. They're under some pressure to find new ways to make money. Is that sort of driving this move away from the whole don't be evil mindset to how do we maximize our value?
Google's founders and team is saying that they're sticking to their goal of really putting the user before the advertiser, which is how I guess they would define not being evil. But clearly, as you said, search advertising growth is really slowed. So Google has to look into new types of advertising. And the one that it's taking the most on right now are these display ads and the banner graphical ads you see on web pages as you browse around. And that industry is full of players that are very much into targeting big companies that are hoarding data. And so that's really caused Google to say, okay, how can we get into this area? What we're trying to, as closely as possible, stick to our principles of letting users know how we're using the data.
Google being the 800-pound gorilla that it is, though, if they make some seismic shift in how they use data, they have the ability to force almost everybody out there to do, in essence, the same thing, right?
Google can influence the market in a number of ways. I mean, one just is the sheer number of users and advertisers it has. If it makes a new sort of ad targeting available, more people are going to see those ads, more advertisers are going to buy them. So, you know, where they draw the line and what they use and how they think about this will shape the industry.
Jessica Vassallaro writes on the media for the Wall Street Journal. Her piece today on Google is part of the paper's What They Know series on privacy and data and all that good stuff. Jessica, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
The governor's race here in California is essentially a dead heat. A poll out this past Friday shows the difference between former eBay CEO Meg Whitman and Attorney General Jerry Brown is within the margin of error for that poll, about 2%. And that is about the only thing that's even in this race. Whitman, the Republican candidate, has already shelled out almost $100 million. She is on track to spend the most money ever in a state election campaign. Her opponent, former Democratic Governor Jerry Brown, has spent less than $1 million. So what is Whitman getting for all that money? April Dembosky reports.
Meg Whitman is everywhere. She's on the web.
Hi, I'm Meg Whitman.
She's on the radio.
When Meg Whitman arrived at eBay, they had...
She's on Spanish radio.
Cuando Meg Whitman llegó a eBay.
And she's all over the television, 16 separate spots and counting.
Putting people back to work would be the most important thing.
According to Whitman's most recent financial disclosure, she spent about $62 million on media buys. She's paid another $8 million for flyers, mailers, and printed materials. And the National Institute on Money and State Politics says nearly 80% of Whitman's spending has come from her own personal fortune, estimated in the billions. That might appeal to voters because she doesn't have to answer to donors. Professor Thad Kauser studies California elections at the University of California, San Diego.
She can be freed from the appearance of corruption that so often drags down candidates. She can say, I'm in nobody's pocket. I'm my own woman because I'm funding my own campaign.
Kauser says relying on her own bank account frees her from the chore of fundraising. It also allows her to be choosy about her press availability. Instead, she can spend her time crafting and controlling her message. Along with the media buys, she spent nearly $10 million on campaign consultants and almost $3 million on new high-tech campaign tools. Whitman declined to be interviewed. Sarah Pompei is a spokeswoman for the campaign.
We're definitely trying to do as much as we can using, you know, the latest and greatest technology available.
Whitman headquarters are in a corporate office park in Cupertino, the heart of Silicon Valley. Pompei said Whitman chose the location in part to draw on the region's know-how to help develop those high-tech campaign tools. One example, something Pompei calls interactive cable TV ads. If Whitman's message inspires you, without leaving the couch, you can order a bumper sticker, volunteer for the campaign, or...
From the push of a button on your remote control, you can actually order a copy of Meg's agenda for creating jobs.
Whitman's also harnessing interactivity on the web. The campaign teamed up with Facebook to launch an ad that popped up on California Facebook pages over 5 days in July. It asked users to choose their top policy priorities. The campaign billed it as the first ever pop-up polling ad and said more than 20,000 responded. Whitman revealed the results of the poll on a web video.
And creating jobs is your number one priority.
Ellen Hoffenblum publishes a guidebook on California elections and has consulted for Republican candidates. He says so far, Whitman's multi-pronged messaging strategy has worked.
I mean, let's be honest. A year ago, nobody in California ever heard of Meg Whitman. Now she's a household name because of the money that she spent.
Recent polls show Whitman and Brown running neck and neck, and a quarter of voters are still undecided. But Thad Kauser says Whitman runs the risk of overexposure.
Spending has diminishing returns. That 185th Meg Whitman commercial is a lot less effective than the second one that people watch. But even more worrisome is that people might resent the fact that you're always on, that you seem to be buying an election.
Kauser says that sentiment is one reason very few self-finance candidates go on to win. But Whitman seems determined to turn that trend on its head. She's expected to spend another $50 million over the final months of the campaign. In Oakland, California, I'm April Demboski for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, the flip side of campaign coin, how Democrat Jerry Brown is spending his money, or rather, not spending it. Coming up. Australian kids learning their Asian ABCs. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Fed wasn't quite enough to keep Wall Street afloat today. The Dow Industrials dropped 54 points. That's 0.5%. Finished at 10,644. The NASDAQ lost 28 points, 1.25%. Closed at 2277. The S&P 500 dipped 6 points, about 0.5%. Ended things at 1121. Bank of America and Citigroup lost 2%. Wells Fargo and JPMorgan Chase each cashed out 1.75%. Goldman Sachs lost nearly 1%. Troubled insurer AIG gave away 3.5% today. Semiconductor companies powered down after analysts worried about subdued computer sales. Advanced Micro Devices charged down 8%. Intel and Teradyne lost 4% apiece. Micron Technology erased 3.5%. Netflix posted a nearly 7% gain today, that after agreeing to an online movie distribution deal with pay TV channel Epix. Fossil ticked up 8%. The watch and jewelry maker projects better than expected profits this year. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for June. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. And the Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins in Saudi Arabia and other parts of the world. The timing depends on the sighting of the new moon. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. People make investments for all kinds of different reasons. College, retirement, maybe there's something about the company you just like, whatever it is. Since the oil leak in the Gulf, one of the things playing into how and why some people invest is the notion of social responsibility. People putting their money in companies or mutual funds that support specific agendas. Some are religious, others environmental. There are a whole bunch. But investors looking to do good with their money have to pay close attention to what those funds themselves invest in. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has been looking into socially responsible investing and how it has changed since the spill. Hey, Adrian.
Hi, Kai.
So nothing like an oil spill to get people thinking about the environment, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. But it's not just pelicans and marshes they're thinking about. Investors have found out the hard way there's a big downside to environmental risk. BP stock price lost about a third of its value. The company's liability is still up in the air. So people are thinking more about these business practices that could leave them vulnerable. According to a report by Edward Jones, 65% of investors are now hesitant to go near oil companies.
So are socially responsible investments a good way to avoid companies like BP?
No, not necessarily.
No, man, come on.
Otherwise, there'd be no story, right?
That's right.
One case in point, the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, which is a benchmark for some socially responsible investment funds, had BP in its index up until the spill. Later, they threw the company out, citing economic effects and the long-term damage to BP's reputation. But the funds based on the Dow Jones Index are far from the only ones invested in oil and gas.
Well, let me ask you about that, because it sort of seems a little oxymoronic, right? Socially responsible investment in oil and gas companies. Help me understand that.
Well, socially responsible investments cover a broad swath of social consciousness, in part, right? It's not just environmental consciousness, but also, you know, these companies want to make money. I called up a socially responsible investment expert named Kerry Krasinski. He teaches about sustainability investing and has written about SRIs. And this is how he explained it.
A socially responsible fund doesn't want to leave possible returns on the table. So if they're concerned that not investing in oil and gas will have them underperform, they've felt the need to invest in certain sectors like oil and gas.
So basically, they want to make money.
Yeah,
they don't want to
money on the table. Thing is an interesting insight. Yeah.
Yeah. So lots of times these funds were looking for sort of best of industry or best of class type investments. BP checked all the right boxes. They had the fancy logo, and they started showing up on some of these lists.
So what is a socially minded investor to do then? I mean, if BP makes the list, what do you do?
You look beyond the title socially responsible, you do your homework, and you actually spend the time to do it. You know, Morningstar sent me a list of the top 10 SRIs by size, so the top 10 largest socially responsible investment funds. And I have been digging through their holdings, looking at each of their top 25 holdings. A ton of them have oil and gas companies, offshore drilling companies. They're all over the place in these things. So you've really just got to drill down and figure it out for yourself.
All right. And you can do that, actually, if you want to. Go to our website, marketplace.org. We've got that list that Adrian mentioned and a whole bunch of other stuff as well. Adrian Hill from our sustainability staff. Adrian, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The rest of the world might be talking about double-dip recessions, but down under, there has barely been a single dip. Australia has been an economic bright spot the past couple of years. That's thanks mostly to commodities, booming exports of iron ore, gold, and uranium to places like China. Australia's future is closely tied to China and the rest of Asia, but its choice of languages has been firmly rooted in its colonial past. So now, in Australia, there's a plan to teach kids how to talk with their neighbors, as Stuart Cohen reports.
Okay, which letters make the A sound? Tiber.
Is it
A-I? Oh, Sakari, you're so pinter, huh?
Scotshead Public School is a tiny elementary school with just 63 students in a seaside village in northern New South Wales. It's hundreds of miles from the nearest big city, but this isolated town is right in the middle of Australia's plans to stay competitive in the coming decades.
Apa kahari mau makan pisang?
Tidak,
tidak.
Scotshead School is one of just four recently chosen by the New South Wales government as part of a test program to become fully bilingual in an Asian language. Here it's Indonesian. The other three schools are in Sydney. They're learning to speak Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. It's part of a broader national plan to build stronger ties with Australia's foremost economically important neighbours.
Oh, well, I'm very, very convinced that, you know, we are an Asian country.
Angie Evans is the Scotshead principal. She started teaching Indonesian 6 years ago after being offered help from a bilingual parent of one of her students. She says it's all about preparing her kids for the country's growing reliance on Asia.
The students will be obviously having jobs mixing with all these different nationalities where they need to be able to converse and communicate with each other. And we have a long way to go in educating the Australian public about Asian countries.
According to the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, more than half of Australia's exports last year went to North Asian countries like Japan and China, while exports to the U.S. and the entire European Union accounted for barely over 15%.
Traditionally, Australia has seen itself as an outpost of Europe. That's really changed now. Our part of the world is here. We are reliant for our future prosperity on the countries of the Asian region.
Kathy Kirby is executive director of the Asia Link Center, which promotes business ties between Australia and the rest of Asia. She says business leaders are starting to realize the country is risking its home court advantage by neglecting Asian language and cultural studies.
We managed to bring together every peak industry group in this country, plus 44 of Australia's top companies who came together and signed off on a statement making the point that they require an Asia-ready workforce and they need the Australian schooling system to deliver that.
Kirby's work has paid off. Australia is in the midst of rolling out its first national school curriculum, and Asian studies feature prominently. And it hasn't hurt that the country's former Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, was an advocate of the idea, himself a fluent Mandarin speaker as a former diplomat in Beijing. At Scott's Head School, some of the more eager students put in extra time playing Indonesian games in the school's computer lab. But it's not all fun and games for many of the students. Despite being just 12 years old, year 6 student Thomas Lynch is looking ahead to his future.
To have a basic understanding of Indonesian will probably help me with my if I ever get into business dealing with Indonesians.
But then again, all work and no play makes life a bit dull.
Because I'm a surfer, when I travel like to Indonesia, I'll be able to speak Indonesian and find out all the good spots to surf.
That enthusiasm is music to the ears of many in Australia's business community. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, one of those economic indicators that kind of cuts both ways. We learned this morning worker productivity fell last month for the first time in a year and a half. It is possibly a sign that the recovery is running out of gas. It is also possibly a sign that companies are finally going to have to start hiring again because they've gotten all they can out of a workforce that has been trimmed back pretty far. Like I said, productivity kind of cuts both ways. Depends on what you want to see. For now, though, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 54 points. That's a 0.5%, finished at 10,644. The NASDAQ off 28 points, about 1.25%, closed at 2277. The S&P 500 dipped 6 points, also a 0.5%, ended things at 1121. Ethan Lindsay and Rod Abid produce our Marketplace Morning Report. That is where you ought to tune to the morning show for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, there is old-fashioned burial, there is cremation, and now,
the body is placed in a container with water and alkaline, and under pressure, the body dissolves.
All righty, then. I'm Kai Rizdahl. That's not going to happen to me for a while, so please, hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.